Good day. This is Kim Harden, and I am reading the Decatur Herald and Review for Monday, December 22nd, 2025. I hope you're having a good day. I'll start with the weather, Decatur's four-day forecast. Today, the regional outlook is breezy today, partly sunny, then mostly cloudy in the afternoon. Expect less than 2 hours of sunshine with average relative humidity 60% and fair drying conditions. Mainly cloudy tonight. The high will be 44 and the low is 41 with winds from the south-southwest. Today 10 to 20 and tonight 7 to 14 miles an hour. Tuesday looks to be mostly cloudy with wind 4 to 8 miles an hour. A high of 53 and a low of 34. Even warmer on Wednesday. Areas of drizzle, wind south 10 to 20 miles an hour, high 59 and a low of 55. And on Thursday, Christmas Day, partly sunny, wind 10 to 20 miles an hour from south-southwest. The high will be 64 and the low will be 48. And I'll start the news with today's headline story, Energy Shortfalls Stalk the State Grid, a report demand driven by data centers as old generators die off. This is written by Jerry Nowicki of Capital News, Illinois. Illinois' electric grids may soon face power shortages and further price increases as fossil fuel plants go offline and data centers fueling the rise of artificial intelligence demand ever increasing amounts of power. That's the conclusion of a new report by three state agencies that foreshadows an upcoming state grid planning process and a potential legislative fight on how lawmakers will regulate power-hungry data centers, if at all. The projected shortfalls would begin in the Commonwealth Edition service territory in northern Illinois by 2029 and in the Ameren service area that covers most of downstate Illinois by 2031. It continue to worsen and make Illinois more reliant on energy imports without action by state policymakers or grid operators. The challenges emerge from a combination of factors at the regional and national scale, the report noted. Load growth is accelerating, driven by data centers, transportation demand, and industrial expansion. At the same time, many coal, gas, and oil units are planned to retire across both RTOs, regional transmission organizations, due to age, economics, and emissions limits. The warning from the Illinois Power Agency, Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, and the Illinois Commerce Commission came the same week that prices once again rose at a procurement event in the area that serves northern Illinois consumers. Advocates behind recent renewable energy reforms and the governor who says he will sign them argue the report's findings prove that a plan passed by lawmakers in October was essential to avoiding a potential crisis. The state set up a deliberate process to address findings from this resource adequacy study and ensure Illinois continues to lead the country in delivering a clean, reliable, affordable energy future for all, Governor J.B. Pritzker's office said in a statement. Critics, including the state's manufacturers, say the report makes clear that Illinois' decarbonization policies were overly ambitious. We didn't need a 222-page report to tell us what we already know. Illinois is facing an energy crisis resulting from the forced closure of dispatchable baseload generation and growing demand, Mark Densler, president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association, said in a statement. Grid planning and capacity. Warnings of the potential shortfall were contained in the most recent resource adequacy report that state regulators are required to file under the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act, or CEJA, energy overhaul passed in 2021. The report, published Monday, precedes a mitigation planning process to be undertaken by the Illinois Power Agency. One of the marquee measures in a CEJA called for taking all of the state's fossil fuel generators offline by 2045. But the plan also created the less heralded resource adequacy process to assess whether that timeline is feasible. While the resource adequacy report didn't specifically call for walking back CEJA's mandatory 2045 fossil fuel plant closure timeline, that possibility could be considered as regulators prepare the mitigation plan and embark on another major grid planning process in 2026. But even if Illinois delays closure dates, it's going to need new generators, the report noted. Another measure the governor has pledged to sign, the Clean and Reliable Grid Affordability Act, aims to add battery generation to the grid while creating other energy efficiency and planning processes. CRGA, Illinois' third major energy and decarbonization bill passed since 2016, requires the Illinois Commerce Commission to conduct an integrated resource planning process in 2026. The report noted the goal is to provide a more comprehensive venue for addressing many of the foundational issues in grid reliability. While the study underscores serious challenges, Illinois has already taken steps to address resource adequacy, a problem the entire country is facing. Solar Powers Illinois, an advocacy group for the state's solar industry that backed CRGA, said in a statement, the group added that integrated resource planning will be a transparent, data-driven process to evaluate supply and demand, identify risks, and secure cost-effective solutions. Problems go beyond Illinois. While Illinois will begin that planning effort next year, the issues facing the state's grids are not unique. The two multi-state federally regulated regional transmission organizations that serve Illinois, PJM Interconnection in northern Illinois, and the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator everywhere else, face their own challenges with out-of-state plant closures and growing load demands. At any rate, the report noted, if the grid can't replace retiring resources in a timely fashion, it would increase grid strain and lead to higher prices at capacity auctions, a cost that could be borne by the consumers. If regional markets remain short, Illinois will face persistent high-capacity prices, even if it builds new resources in-state, the report noted. PJM serves 67 million customers in 13 states and Washington, D.C., including 4.2 million Commonwealth Edison customers in northern Illinois, making it the largest grid operator in the United States. On Wednesday, it announced the results of its most recent auction for capacity, which describes payments ratepayers make to power generators to ensure grid reliability. Capacity charges make up roughly 20% of a monthly power bill. The price per megawatt day at the most recent PJM auction hit a record of $333.44 for the 2027-28, up $4.27 from the previous year, but still 11.5 times higher than just 3 years prior. The Citizens Utility Board, an Illinois consumer advocacy group, said the news shows the capacity market is breaking under the weight of data center demand and a dysfunctional interconnection queue. PJM's interconnection queue largely dictates how quickly new generators can come online, and advocates and the governor have long called for reforms. The report noted it has improved since PJM created new processes in 2023, but it still takes 5 to 7 years to get gas turbines online. While citing and permitting can also cause delays. The report also noted supply chain disruptions, tariffs, and domestic content requirements for tax credit eligibility could also delay wind and solar coming online. Without real reforms in just a few years, 67 million electric customers in the PJM footprint could face rolling blackouts and an escalation of power bills that make the current price spikes seem tame, CUB Executive Director Sarah Moskowitz said in a statement. Report's recommendations. As fossil fuel plants in Illinois go offline due to CEJA's mandates, it could make the state reliant on importing energy from other zones within the regional transmission organizations, even as the RTOs themselves face shortfalls. Because of that, the state will need new generation, even if Illinois retains a portion of its existing thermal fleet. To address the potential shortages, Illinois must employ a diversified resource strategy, according to the report. This includes combining continued growth of new in-state wind and solar supported by IPA procurements and programs, greater use of existing and planned transmission to import power from MISO and PJM when available, and the continued use of fueled thermal generators as reliability assets even as their energy output declines with higher renewable penetration, the report noted. Other potential resources cited in the report include green hydrogen, nuclear fission reactors, utility-scale solar, onshore wind, and 4-hour lithium-ion batteries. The CRGA, which passed the state legislature in October and the governor said he will sign, creates a new incentive structure for energy storage projects similar to how the state funds renewable developments like wind and solar power. Data centers and advocate response. The advocates behind CRGA say it was passed in large part because lawmakers understood the trends that were outlined in this week's report. But renewable energy advocates like the Illinois Clean Jobs Coalition and consumer advocates like the CUB say it's just as essential to regulate power-hungry data centers. The next critical step is to pass common sense guardrails for data centers, the primary driver of the unprecedented energy demand that is saddling Illinois consumers with rising utility bills while dirty energy companies make record profits, the Clean Jobs Coalition said in a statement. The influential coalition, which includes union, faith, and environmental groups, said it will work with lawmakers to ensure data center developers, not Illinois consumers, pay for the disproportionate energy burden big tech is bringing to our power grid. Pritzker's office didn't directly respond to questions about what data center regulations, if any, the governor and lawmakers will consider in the spring. Illinois has provided tax incentives for data centers since Pritzker signed bipartisan legislation in 2019. According to the state's 2024 report, 27 data centers had received incentives totaling $983 million in tax breaks and benefits. The National Resource Defense Council estimated data centers will drive up costs for PJM consumers by another $163 billion through 2033 and increase monthly bills by $70 in 2028. The Citizens Utility Board called on PJM to clean up its interconnection queue while urging states to force data centers to reduce operations or use on-site backup battery systems when electricity is in high demand. Advocates also called for the renewal of a proposal requiring data centers to power themselves with renewable energy, which stalled in the spring. Data center companies are among the wealthiest in the world, and it is simply unconscionable that customers should pay unbearably high power costs to foot the bill for data center energy guzzling, Moskowitz said. The Manufacturers Association have long called for a repeal of CEJA's closure date to reduce uncertainty. The group called for an all-of-the-above approach that includes keeping fossil fuels online. If skyrocketing power bills were not warning enough, this new report is a flashing red sign that Illinois needs to act immediately, Densler said in a statement. With electricity demand only expected to increase, we simply cannot risk the chaos that would be caused by the premature closure of baseload generation plants as required under current law. This next story by Steph Kugeljohn of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch looks at Southwest Illinois, the Gateway Arch backers eye expansion into Metro East. The Gateway Arch Park Foundation and the National Park Service are considering a new bridge over Interstate 44 into the Arch grounds and a possible expansion of the park into East St. Louis. The Foundation and Park Service, which oversees the arch, have started environmental testing in the Metro East and are working with St. Louis-based PGAV on what an expansion there could look like. Ryan McClure, the foundation's executive director, said Tuesday. The goal, he said, is for the Arch Grounds expansion to become an economic driver for East St. Louis, a former industrial powerhouse that now has less than a quarter of the residents it had in its heyday. That's an imperative, McClure said. The foundation, a nonprofit dedicated to the preservation of the Arch Grounds, also will work with the Missouri Department of Transportation, City of St. Louis, and regional planning organization East-West Gateway Council on Governments on how to address I-44, which separates downtown from the Arch and the Mississippi River. McClure said the organizations want to take advantage of the planned maintenance work on the Poplar Street Bridge and I-64 over the next 15 years to consider redesigning the sections of highway that run through downtown to, for instance, improve the Arch Grounds, better connect the riverfront to downtown, and boost walkability. Other cities across the United States, including Kansas City, San Francisco, and Boston, have undergone similar retooling of their highways. The foundation is one of the organizations working to revitalize downtown St. Louis after a few tough years as crime spiked during the pandemic, and more recently, big companies have fled. The foundation bought the Millennium Hotel, one of downtown's eyesores, and aims to remake St. Louis skyline there with new housing, office, entertainment, and other amenities. No one organization is capable of doing what it takes to move downtown forward. We all need to work together, and we are, McClure said. That is something to believe in, and I hope St. Louisans are asking themselves, how can I be part of that? Other civic and city leaders have floated ideas of a metro expansion and highway changes over the years. A move into Illinois was envisioned when plans first emerged for a Jefferson National Expansion Memorial in the early 20th century. Federal legislation later approved in the 1980s and 90s also allows for the expansion into the Metro East. In the early 1980s, an organization bought 50 acres in Illinois to kickstart an expansion. The group built out what is now known as Malcolm W. Martin Memorial Park. Though plans to officially expand the Arch Grounds never moved forward after the idea failed to get enough federal funding. East St. Louis officials could not be reached on Tuesday for comment. The recent revamp of the Arch Grounds, which wrapped up in 2018, totaled more than $380 million. About two-thirds of that money came from private donations. McClure said that costs of either proposal have not been determined, but he hopes private donors will help. Meanwhile, the foundation is starting demolition of the long-vacant Millennium Hotel. The work, McClure said, is part of the foundation's mission. At the end of the day, we are here to ensure that everything around the Arch is well-supported, well-connected, and vibrant. And that's what we're doing, McClure said. A story from the Associated Press by Jennifer Peltz and Jamie Ding writes, World War II Navy veteran Schaub dies at 105. Chicago-born sailor who survived Pearl Harbor bombing in 1941. World War II Navy veteran Ira Ike Schaub, one of the dwindling number of survivors of the 1941 Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor, has died. He was 105 years old. Daughter Kimberly Henricks told the Associated Press that Schaub died at home early Saturday in the presence of her and her husband. With his passing, there remains only about a dozen survivors of the surprise attack, which killed just over 2,400 troops and propelled the United States into the war. Schaub was a sailor of just 21 at the time of the attack, and for decades he rarely spoke about the experience. But in recent years, aware that the core of survivors was dwindling, the centenarian made a point of traveling from his home in Beaverton, Oregon, to the annual observance at the Hawaii military base. To pay honor to the guys that didn't make it, he said in 2023. For last year's commemoration, Schaub spent weeks building up the strength to be able to stand and salute. But this year, he did not feel well enough to attend, and less than 3 weeks later, he died. Born on Independence Day in 1920 in Chicago, Schaub was the eldest of three brothers. He joined the Navy at 18, following in the footsteps of his father, he said in a February interview for Pacific Historic Parks. On what began as a peaceful Sunday, December 7, 1941, Schaub, who played the tuba in the USS Dobbins Band, was expecting a visit from his brother, a fellow service member assigned to a nearby naval radio station. Schaub had just showered and donned a clean uniform when he heard a call for fire rescue. He went topside and saw another ship, the USS Utah, capsizing. Japanese planes roared through the air. We were pretty startled. Startled and scared to death, Schaub recalled in 2023. We didn't know what to expect, and we knew that if anything happened to us, that would be it. He scurried back below deck to grab boxes of ammunition and joined a daisy chain of sailors feeding shells to an anti-aircraft gun above. His ship lost three sailors, according to Navy records. One was killed in action, and two died later of fragment wounds from a bomb that struck the stern. All had been manning an anti-aircraft gun. Schaub spent most of the war with the Navy in the Pacific, going to the New Hebrides, now known as Vanuatu, and then to the Mariana Islands and Okinawa, Japan. After the war, he studied aerospace engineering and worked on the Apollo spaceflight program as an electrical engineer for General Dynamics, helping send astronauts to the moon. Schaub's son also joined the Navy and is a retired commander. Speaking at a 2022 ceremony, Schaub asked people to honor those who served at Pearl Harbor. Remember what they're here for. Remember and honor those that are left. They did a hell of a job, he said. Those who are still here, dead or alive. In national news, another story from the Associated Press by Amer Mandahi. U.S. pursues third tanker off of Venezuela from West Palm Beach, Florida. The U.S. Coast Guard pursued another sanctioned oil tanker Sunday in the Caribbean Sea as the Trump administration appeared to intensify its targeting of such vessels connected to Venezuelan government. The pursuit of the tanker, confirmed by a U.S. official briefed on the operation, came after the U.S. administration announced Saturday that it seized a tanker for the second time in less than 2 weeks. The official, who was not authorized to comment publicly about the ongoing operation and spoke on the condition of anonymity, said Sunday's pursuit involved a sanctioned dark fleet vessel that is part of Venezuela's illegal sanctions evasion. The official said the vessel flew a false flag and was under a judicial seizure order. The Coast Guard's pursuit of the tanker was first reported by Reuters. Saturday's pre-dawn seizure of a Panama-flagged vessel called Centuries targeted what the White House described as a falsely flagged vessel operating as part of the Venezuelan shadow fleet to traffic stolen oil. The Coast Guard, with assistance from the Navy, seized a sanctioned tanker called Skipper on December 10th, another part of the shadow fleet of tankers that the U.S. says operates on the fringes of the law to move sanctioned cargo. It was not flying a nation's flag when it was seized by the Coast Guard. President Trump, after that first seizure, said the U.S. would carry out a blockade of Venezuela as he ratcheted up his rhetoric toward Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. This past week, Trump demanded that Venezuela return assets it seized from the U.S. oil companies years ago, justifying anew his announcement of a blockade against oil tankers traveling to or from the South American country that faces American sanctions. Trump cited the lost U.S. investments in Venezuela when asked about his newest tactic in a pressure campaign against Maduro, suggesting the Republican administration's moves are at least somewhat motivated by disputes over oil investments, along with accusations of drug trafficking. Some sanctioned tankers also diverted away from Venezuela. U.S. oil companies dominated Venezuela's petroleum industry until the country's leaders moved to nationalize the sector, first in the 1970s and again in the 21st century under Maduro and his predecessor, Hugo Chavez. Compensation that Venezuela offered was deemed insufficient, and in 2014, an international arbitration panel ordered the country's socialist government to pay $1.6 billion to ExxonMobil. Maduro said in a message Sunday on Telegram that Venezuela spent months denouncing, challenging, and defeating a campaign of aggression that goes from psychological terrorism to corsairs attacking oil tankers. He added, "We are ready to accelerate the pace of our deep revolution." U.S. Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, who is critical of Trump's Venezuela policy, called the tanker seizures a provocation and a prelude to war. "Look, at any point in time, there are 20, 30 governments around the world that we don't like that are either socialist or communist or have human rights violations," Paul said on ABC's This Week, but it isn't the job of the American soldier to be the policeman of the world. The targeting of tankers comes as Trump ordered the Defense Department to attack vessels in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific Ocean that his administration alleges smuggle fentanyl and other illegal drugs to the United States and beyond. At least 104 people were killed in 28 known strikes since early September. The strikes face scrutiny from U.S. lawmakers and human rights activists who say the administration offered scant evidence that its targets are drug smugglers and argue the strikes amount to extrajudicial killings. Trump repeatedly said Maduro's days in power are numbered. White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles said in an interview with Vanity Fair published last week that Trump wants to keep on blowing up boats until Maduro cries uncle. Democrats pressed Trump to seek congressional authorization for the military action in the Caribbean. Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat, Virginia, told NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday that Trump's use of military to mount pressure on Maduro runs contrary to Trump's pledge to keep the U.S. out of unnecessary wars. We should be using sanctions and other tools at our disposal to punish this dictator who is violating the human rights of his civilians and has run the Venezuelan economy into the ground, Kaine said. But I'll tell you, we should not be waging war against Venezuela. We definitely should not be waging war without a vote of Congress. Rod McQuirk of the AP writes, "Nation mourns shooting victims. Crowd gathers at scene, moment of silence held a week after the attack. In Melbourne, Australia, thousands of mourners gathered Sunday evening under tight police security at Sydney's iconic Bondi Beach to mark a week since two gunmen targeting a Jewish festival killed 15 people there. Since then, Australian governments were galvanized into action to counter anti-Semitism and tighten already strict national gun controls. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, his predecessors John Howard and Scott Morrison, and Governor General Sam Mostyn, who represents Australia's head of state, King Charles III, were among the dignitaries at the commemoration that drew more than 10,000 people. This has to be the nadir of anti-Semitism in our country, New South Wales Jewish Board of Deputies President David Ossip told the crowd. This has to be the moment when light starts to eclipse the darkness. The crowd booed Albanese when Ossip acknowledged his presence. Opposition leaders Susan Ley, who said a conservative government led by her would reverse a decision made by Albanese's center-left Labour Party government this year to recognize a Palestinian state, was cheered. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu lashed out at Albanese over the attack on the Hanukkah celebration, saying, "Your call for a Palestinian state pours fuel on the anti-Semitic fire." Netanyahu repeatedly sought to link widespread calls for a Palestinian state and criticism of Israel's military offensive in Gaza after Hamas's 2023 attack to growing incidences of anti-Semitism worldwide. Images of the victims, aged 10 to 87, were projected in the commemoration. Waltzing Matilda was sung in honor of the youngest victim, whose Ukrainian parents gave their Australian-born daughter what they said was the most Australian name they knew. A widely acclaimed hero of the massacre, Ahmed Al-Ahmed, sent a message of support from his hospital bed. The Syrian-born immigrant was shot after wrestling a shotgun from one of the gunmen. "The Lord is close and brokenhearted. Today I stand with you, my brothers and sisters," he wrote. The father, Mohammed Fateh Al-Ahmed, was invited to light a candle on the Jewish candelabra, known as a menorah, in the final night of Hanukkah. Beyond the famous beach, people around Australia united with Sydney's stricken Jewish community by lighting candles and observing 1 minute of silence at their homes at 6:47 to remember the moment the massacre, which inspired Islamic State terrorist group, unfolded. The federal and New South Wales state governments declared Sunday a national day of reflection to mark Australia's worst mass shooting since 35 were killed in Tasmania in 1996. Indigenous leaders held a traditional ceremony in the morning at the waterfront Bondi Pavilion, where an impromptu memorial is set to be cleared Monday. One of the suspects, Naveed Akram, 24, was shot by police. He was charged with 15 counts of murder, 40 counts of causing harm with intent to murder in relation to those wounded. His father, Akram, 50, was shot dead by police at the scene. The health department said 13 of those wounded at Bondi remain in Sydney hospitals on Sunday. This concludes part one, and I will be back in a few moments.